Here, with help from Richard Meets in optometry.
There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. For podcasts, click on the podcast button. For a moment of science, I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
In sports, it's time for the men's U.S. Olympic basketball team to get down to business. Mike Krzyzewski's squad is opening training camp today in Las Vegas to continue preparations for next month's Beijing Games. They're determined to improve on the 2004 squad's disappointing bronze medal finish in Athens. Two-time Grand Slam champion Mary Pierce withdrew today from the Olympics because of an injury and will be replaced by Amelie Mauresmo. The 33-year-old Pierce, who hasn't played since knee surgery in 2006, was a surprise selection by France over Mauresmo in singles. Hank Aaron's childhood home in his native Mobile, Alabama, will be renovated and turned into a museum once it's moved next to the stadium named for the Hall of Famer and one-time home run king. Hank Aaron Stadium, known as the Hank, is home to the minor league Mobile Bay Bears. The White Sox will try to stay atop their division tonight when they open a three-game series against the Texas Rangers. Chicago leads the AL Central by one-half game over second-place Minnesota. The St. Louis Cardinals and Milwaukee Brewers start a critical four-game series at Busch Stadium tonight. Both teams have come storming out of the All-Star break to significantly tighten the race atop the NL Central. Last postseason, the Arizona Diamondbacks eliminated the Cubs, marking the 99th straight year Chicago failed to win a World Series title. The Cubs are hoping Rich Harden can help them end that championship drought. Harden takes the mound for the Cubs tonight in a three-game series opener in Phoenix, Arizona. That's a look at sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designers of the M2 on Neal mixed-use project in downtown Champaign. On the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 242, 87 degrees in Urbana. 63 years after World War II, the hunt goes on for Nazi-era war criminals. Last week, the Justice Department accused an 86-year-old man living near Seattle of having served in a notorious police unit of the SS. NPR's Martin Casti reports.
Peter Egner immigrated from Yugoslavia in the 1960s, finding work in restaurants around the Pacific Northwest. He seems to have made a good impression on people, which may explain the current state of shock at his retirement community, a woodsy place just down the street from Microsoft. One of his neighbors, Maria Milosova, says nobody had any idea.
He moved in here like I moved in, but do they know about me? I also came from Europe.
Milosova, who immigrated from Czechoslovakia, says all she knows is what the government says, that Egner served in the SS, and she gives him the benefit of the doubt, especially because he was so young at the time.
If you are in the army, German army, and you are 19, you know what is it? Maulhalten und weiter dienen.
That's German for shut your mouth and keep serving.
So, you know, life is not easy. Life is not a straight white line.
But the government says Egner did more than just keep his head down. It wants to strip him of his U.S. citizenship because investigators say that when he immigrated, he concealed the fact that he'd been a guard and an interpreter for a special SS police unit in Belgrade, a unit that killed thousands of civilians. His lawyer, Robert Gibbs, says the government has not shown that Egner was personally responsible for any crimes.
This guy was like a private. It just seems that they're really reaching to the bottom of the barrel in terms of level of involvement of people.
Are these individuals Hitler and Eichmann? No, but in general, the victims themselves never encountered Hitler and Eichmann.
Eli Rosenbaum is often called the Justice Department's top Nazi hunter. He can't talk specifically about his case against Egner, but he rejects the idea that he's going after the small fry.
To their victims, these are the perpetrators of the Holocaust and other Nazi crimes.
As the perpetrators of the Holocaust die off, Rosenbaum's Office of Special Investigations has been asked to broaden its scope. He says cases from other conflicts now make up most of the OSI's work. But so far, those cases have resulted in relatively few charges. Pamela Merchant is executive director of the Center for Justice and Accountability, a human rights organization in San Francisco.
The Justice Department has had a very strong mission of focusing on the former Nazis, which they've done for many, many years. This more expanded mission of looking at human rights abusers from other countries is a relatively new idea, and my sense is that the DOJ is still in a ramping up posture.
Eli Rosenbaum acknowledges that his office finds modern war crimes cases to be more challenging. For example, there's less of a paper trail in Rwanda, he says, than there was in bureaucratic Nazi Germany.
We don't have much documentary evidence, if any. The modern cases tend to be witness-driven. Witness testimony is often difficult to find, but we'll be filing cases, and they'll be very important cases.
In the meantime, he's still filing the World War II cases. The OSI currently has 15 Nazi-era defendants in court, and he says there are twice as many under investigation. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
Are they a symbol of the Old West or a pest? The Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, says it may have to begin killing wild horses to deal with a surplus of horses in holding facilities. It's one option on the table as the Bureau faces rising costs and budget cuts, and it's prompted wild horse advocates to rally around the animals. NPR's John McChesney reports from Nevada, where half of the nation's wild horse population lives.
Someone whispers, "Here they come," and over a mile away, a small plume of dust can be seen against sage-covered mountains, followed by flashing helicopter blades. Soon, dark dots emerge on the valley, then flowing manes and tails as the chopper pilot herds the racing horses into a funnel-shaped trap. A wrangler releases a so-called Judas horse, who's trained to lead the wild ones into the final approach to the trap. The captives mill about, wild-eyed and confused. They look sleek and in good health. In the holding pen, a mare aggressively protects her foal. Glenna Eckel is a wild horse specialist with BLM.
There's a social hierarchy here, you know, of different family bands, and now we've got them all mixed together in this kind of a situation where they're getting kind of rustled around.
Whoa.
Here, mama.
That whack you heard was a mama rearing up and delivering a double-hoofed kick to an encroaching mare. That's one way the new hierarchy is decided here. BLM captures about 10 to 12,000 horses a year, about half of them in Nevada alone. Not enough, according to ranchers. Too many, according to animal rights activists. And Glenna Eckel says letting Darwinian nature take its course with the wild horse won't work, because it has no natural predator, and populations double every 4 years.
Well, yeah, horses die, but before all that happens, you've potentially ruined your soils, you've destroyed your plant communities. The wildlife and the other critters that rely on this country are probably long dead or moved out of the country. We have got to balance the horses with the other animals. It's a bigger, more complex picture than just horses.
Those other critters are deer and elk and, of course, cattle. We'll get to those critters in a minute. BLM faces another dilemma. What to do with all the horses now in captivity? 30,000 of them, nearly equal to the number still in the wild. This is the Wild Horse Adoption Center in Palomino Valley, just north of Reno, Nevada. Horses here are thrashing about in a steel-walled channel that leads them to a veterinarian station where they'll be vaccinated, dewormed, and branded with a cold iron dipped in liquid nitrogen. There are 1,000 formerly wild horses here. Susie Stokey is with the BLM.
Our adoption market's clearly down. It's been on a downward trend for the last decade. We used to adopt around 8,000 animals annually. And certainly the economy, fuel prices, hay prices, all those things are having a factor in terms of our adoption market.
So the Bureau is looking at unpopular options like euthanasia.
Or even possibly considering options like sale without limitation.
That's a Bureau euphemism for selling horses for slaughter. Dr. Michael Kirk is an equine veterinarian with the Nevada Wild Horse Commission, who believes euthanasia should only be used to prevent suffering.
I think it's a cop-out to use
euthanasia as a convenience to cut down numbers of healthy horses, if you will, to me, just the public's not going to stand for it.
One public group that's not going to stand for it is the Animal Welfare Institute. Chris Hyde speaks for the Institute.
The reason we're in this position is simply because of horrendous management of the program by the Bureau of Land Management. We've been screaming about this for decades, that the system is broken, that they're not managing it properly. And, you know, sadly, in the last 10 years, it's gotten even worse because of their proposal to do mass roundups.
Hyde and others say the BLM has a built-in conflict of interest, that it's a tool of cattlemen who graze cows on the same public land used by wild horses. Third-generation rancher Ron Cherry is president of the Nevada Cattlemen's Association. He says BLM's gatherings must continue.
Right now, the West, and in particular Nevada, is facing a drought. Stopping these gathers would lead to the ranges being overused. It would lead to horses starving. It would lead to horses dying for lack of water. It just isn't something that the public would want to see, and it's not something that ranchers would want to see.
BLM and others are no doubt counting on public pressure to increase the budget for care of this national symbol. Meanwhile, a lot of fine horses remain in BLM corrals waiting for someone to adopt them. John McChesney, NPR News.
Sounds Wild follows wildlife biologists as they travel the world. Today's NPR Sounds Wild story comes from the Guatemalan rainforest. Biologist Greg Budney with the Cornell University Laboratory of Ornithology recently caught the sound of the keel-billed toucan. He also heard a secretive and unusual mammal called the coati mundi.
What we're hearing are two keel-billed toucans, spectacular large toucans, calling back and forth to one another. And in the background, something that attracted my attention is this huffing sound, which I immediately realized was not a bird and had a very mammalian quality. I was able to see through the vegetation of the trees up into the upper branches that there was a large mammal. It looked like someone had taken a raccoon by the tip of the nose and the tail and just stretched it. And it had either noticed my presence or was disturbed by something else in the area and began this huffing sound. I was in a Mayan archaeological site called Tintal. In a forested environment, it's really, really difficult to see all the animals that live there. And if you have to rely upon sight, you're only going to detect a small presence of what's actually there. By listening, you dramatically expand your range of detection, your ability to assess numbers.
That's biologist Greg Budney. He's with the Cornell University Laboratory of Ornithology, and he was reporting from the Guatemalan rainforest. It's baseball season, but instead of reviewing the rules of the game, commentator Amy Guida reviews the laws of the game, key when something baseball-related causes injury. Here's this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
You know the song about the old ball game, Peanuts and Cracker Jack? There's some suggestion that attendees never want to get back, but no one's supposed to take that literally. And yet this summer, two separate events could have prevented return trips home for an unlucky boy and what police say was an ill-mannered man. The boy got hit in the head with a foul ball at Wrigley Field. The man allegedly spit sunflower seeds at an umpire at a kid's baseball game outside Chicago. The events themselves are different, of course. One involved an unintentional physical injury, and the second, police say, may have involved an intentional but probably mostly psychic injury. And because of their differences, they help illustrate some interesting points about the law of battery. Sometimes a sunflower seed packs more of a punch than a baseball. Battery, to put it simply, is an intentional unwanted touch. A left hook, for example, planted in a place other than a boxing ring. It's a wrong found in both tort law and criminal law. That means that one active battery can potentially lead to two separate court actions, one filed by the person injured and one filed on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois through the local state's attorney. In tort law, the defendant can be forced to pay damages to the plaintiff. In criminal law, of course, the defendant can be forced to pay a fine or even go to prison. You probably heard about the ball that beamed the boy in Chicago this summer at Wrigley Field. The boy could sue, arguing that the batter committed battery or some other tort that led to his injury, but the boy probably wouldn't win. Sure, it's an unwanted touching, but it wasn't intentional. And if he sued for accidental injury, another barrier would be waiting. Courts have routinely held that those who attend baseball games should know that there's a danger of a foul ball lurking behind every swing of the bat. It's the old assumption of the risk problem. Even young Americans are charged with knowing the full dangers of the national pastime. The criminal law would be similarly uninterested. In Illinois, criminal battery is intentional physical contact of an insulting or provoking nature with an individual. If a ball player intentionally hit the ball toward a heckler, say, there might be a case, but not when a foul ball goes astray. This also explains why the man outside Chicago, who allegedly spit sunflower seeds at an umpire, faces battery charges. If the sunflower spitting story is true, that could well be a battery, even though whatever allegedly hit the umpire had a lot less heft than the baseball that hit the boy. Police say one charge is the even more serious aggravated battery. And remember the overlap between criminal law and tort law? If things happened as news reports claim, and assuming the sunflower seeds found their mark, the umpire could sue the spitter for tortious battery. An umpire might assume the risk of a foul ball, sure, but not foul behavior involving sunflower seeds. Under the law, then, an arcing sunflower seed can lead to more liability than a bat-propelled baseball. And with aggravated battery being a felony, in the old ball game, sometimes it's the peanuts and Cracker Jack that could mean you never get back. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois.
Earth and Sky.
Today, a student from the Caribbean island of Bonaire asks the scientists about something all animals do.
I'm Ziran, I'm 15 years old, and my question is, why do people yawn?
For an answer, Earth Sky asked a neuroscientist at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. He studied yawning for over 30 years, but says why we yawn is still something of a mystery. Here's Dr. Robert Provine.
Yawning is a curious behavior because on one level you can say that we don't really understand why we do it. So throughout our life, in fact, you know, even before birth, we start yawning, and it's unclear about why we produce this act.
Provine said you might yawn because you're tired, anxious, or bored.
What all of these things have in common is that